Hello, I'm Alice, and welcome to Team GP Perspectives, peer-to-peer conversations digging into anything and everything general practice, brought to you by the RCGP Membership Communities and Engagement Team. A warning for listeners that this episode may contain some descriptions of war and conflict. In August 2021, the world watched as the Taliban executed an unchallenged takeover of Kabul, leading to Afghanistan once again living under Taliban rule. As citizens, vulnerable groups and allies evacuated the city, the BMA released a statement, co-signed by the RCGP, fellow Royal Medical Colleges and governing bodies, condemning the oppression and danger being faced by Afghan women, in particular, their rights and access to healthcare. This highlighted the adversity faced by thousands of people displaced from their homes, either through conflict or persecution, and the complex and varied health needs they require as patients, and how that care can be delivered to them. 2 months before this recording took place, Russian military forces had invaded Ukraine, forcing a reported 1 million Ukrainians to evacuate to neighbouring countries and to further afield. According to the Refugee Council, there were over 48,000 applications for asylum made in the UK in the past 12 months, and over 100,000 awaiting an initial decision on their application. In the lead up to Refugee Week on 20th of June, Team GP Perspectives will be releasing a series of podcasts focusing on refugee and displaced doctors, their voices, health needs as patients, and the organisations set up to support their settlement and retraining. In this episode, I'm honoured to be joined by two GPs who'll be sharing their experiences working with displaced patients who are refugees or seeking asylum, and discussing the complex health needs they may experience and how GPs and primary care workers can support them. If you could briefly introduce yourselves and your remit.
Hi, I'm Harine De Silva. I'm a portfolio GP based in London most of the time, but currently I'm a medical coordinator for a German non-governmental organisation called CADIS, and I'm currently working in Iraq and Syria, and I'm currently recording from Iraq.
Hi, I'm Emily. I'm a GP based in Norwich with a keen interest in inclusion healthcare, particularly in those seeking asylum and refuge. I've been working with that group as a GP, both in Salford, in Greater Manchester and in Norwich. And I've held various roles with the NIHR and Health Education England, looking at trying to improve knowledge of the workforce in these areas.
Thank you both for joining me for this Refugee Week mini-series. And thank you, Harine, for joining us from Iraq. I'd like to start off by asking you about common issues you may see presented in refugees or people seeking asylum. And if I could come to you first, Emily.
The issues can be complex, but they can be the same issues that you or I face and you or I need to go to our GP about. And I think the more complex health issues that you may see can be things that we wouldn't necessarily see in the UK general population. So, for example, there could be specific health needs around infectious disease. There could be non-communicable diseases that have not been managed on the migration journey. There may have been gaps in long-term medication leading to worsening of chronic diseases. And obviously, mental health is a huge aspect of care. And that is not just sort of diagnosed, you know, mental health conditions such as post-traumatic stress disorder, which can be more common, but also more kind of low-level the mental distress, which can be a huge issue, and that can be quite common in groups that are seeking asylum. These, we call them post-migration stresses, so lots of issues that they face in the UK throughout their time trying to seek asylum, trying to get a positive decision, and I'm more than happy to sort of speak through some of those issues. They can, obviously, in where I work, we have the Home Office accommodation for dispersed asylum seekers. So these are people who are seeking asylum. So they're going through the Home Office process, which can be incredibly brutal for individuals. They may have to have several interviews. They may have to repeat their story several times. And they live in poverty. So an asylum seeker in the UK gets, whilst they're seeking asylum, they are entitled to £39.63 a week. And they get placed in Home Office accommodation, which can be of poor quality. They could be moved without much notice. They have little choice on where they go, being unable to work, unable to volunteer. They have some access to state education, but it's not much. So they have a huge amount of time on their hands to kind of think about where they've been, what they've been through, and their current situation and the uncertainty around their asylum claim. obviously there's issues around language, isolation, and kind of lacking that community, particularly if they end up in somewhere like Norwich, which is, you know, it's not that ethnically diverse. So they may struggle to kind of find people who speak their language or their or have the same religious beliefs as they do, with, you know, huge amount of stress and mental distress.
You just mentioned isolation, which some people might experience on their journeys or while they're living or resettling in the UK. Do you tend to see patients who have travelled by themselves and arrived by themselves, or have they come with family or children? And is there a difference in demographic between men and women who are travelling, or even a difference between age group?
We have a mixture. So probably worth to bring in the kind of definitions at this point. An asylum seeker is somebody who is actively seeking asylum. So essentially they're making a claim that on arrival to the UK, it's unsafe for them to return to their country of origin due to persecution, trafficking, etc. Throughout that seeking asylum process, they are placed in Home Office accommodation. They're given, as I said, £39.63 on a preloaded card. They're often in houses of multiple occupancy. So, for example, I work in the most deprived practice in Norwich, and this accommodation, which is run by Serco, is on one of the kind of roughest roads in Norwich, part, you know, right in the estate, usually 4 or 5 bedroom houses where they have individual rooms, very sort of basic. As I said, no choice in where they go. So, for example, I've got a trans woman who's an Iranian Kurd, and she's trans, and she's been placed in a house with 3 other Kurds who are Iraqi men. And obviously that's a hugely challenging situation for her. And then a refugee is obviously someone who's been brought to the UK under a protected person scheme. So, for example, the Afghan, many individuals were brought under a resettlement scheme. We also have quite a few Syrian families who were brought under a resettlement scheme, and or, you know, somebody who's had asylum granted.
Thank you for making the distinction between those terms, Emily, which is really important when we're having these conversations. Listeners can click on the Refugee Council website in the description box below, which does have a comprehensive list of definitions as well. Emily, you did just mention the scheme that Syrian families have journeyed to the UK under, so I'd like to take this opportunity to turn to Hareen, who has been working on the front lines in Syria and in Iraq. Hareen, would you be able to tell us more about the patients and issues you're working on the ground with?
Yes, so I'm currently working in Syria's Al-Hol refugee camp, which is in northeast Syria. I work for the organisation, which we're running a field hospital. And that field hospital essentially looks after about 68,000 people within this camp, and it's dire conditions, unfortunately. It's mostly women and children in this camp. Essentially, there is a lack of education. That's one of the things that Emily mentioned, just in mainstream education in the UK, accessing that is quite difficult. And imagine not being able to access that in the camp itself. And things you mentioned before, it's untreated chronic health diseases, untreated mental health issues, and just widening that gap. And unfortunately, Syria is potentially moving into a famine with poor rain over the past season. And also with what's happened in Ukraine, unfortunately, with, I can't remember the percentage, over half of its wheat is imported from Ukraine, fuel shortages as well because of the war, etc. And there's a lot of different things that are going on. It's so complex, the health issues that affect people, and specifically mental health as well, which is one of the things that is very difficult for international organizations and local organizations to implement in areas of conflict, etc. It's the first initial reaction is to sort out everyone's emergency health, then it's chronic disease, and then mental health is, unfortunately, it's not a low priority, but it's very difficult. And that's why the WHO now has what they call the mental health gap training. So they're trying to train up all of the primary healthcare people and the secondary healthcare staff to try and understand, diagnose, and refer onto the appropriate agencies if needed.
And how long might you be seeing people stay in these camps before they're being processed, especially as you're seeing them at the initial stages of their journeys?
I have this arbitrary way to set out what the mental health issues could be relating to. So it's pre-departure. So people are leaving their home. What's caused them to leave? One of the stories talking about Emily's female trans patient, the Iranian Kurd. There's a lot of people out there who are in minority groups within these countries who unfortunately are worried about persecution, obviously war, journalists, etc. And there are so many other groups that I've probably missed out that are scared, have to leave, and then you end up in a refugee camp or going from informal settlements to informal settlements, trying to find a safe haven. And that's when you have the transit issues that can relate to mental health, such as the fear of sexual violence, fear of more violence against you, arduous journey, the stress of it if you're taking children with you. And then again, what Emily said was, even though you're in the, let's say, the UK, it doesn't end there. There are issues trying to integrate into society, all the paperwork, the application process for seeking asylum is long and it's very difficult. And then obviously trying to navigate the health system in the UK as well. Going back to the question, how long these people will stay here, I am unsure. It's years, some people. Al Hol camp, it is the world's most dangerous refugee camp, according to the UN. And we have a whole section which is dedicated to third country nationals. So those are people who are outside of Syria and Iraq, who ended up there, so from countries such as the UK, such as Shamim Begum, who was in the camp I worked at, is now in a different camp. People unfortunately ended up there fighting for ISIS and unfortunately can't leave because other their European countries won't take them back, or their other countries. And these people, unfortunately, are just stuck in limbo. And they have children that are born in this camp, which these children, unfortunately, don't have an obvious future that I can see at the moment, which is terrifying for me to think of, and especially for a family, a parent, to think of that as well. And that adds to a lot of mental health stress, and obviously development of that child as well. It will be affected.
It is concerning to consider a generation of young children and babies being born into such an unstable environment. And whilst you're trying to deliver emergency physical care, you're unable to address possible long-term trauma disorders like post-migration stress, which Emily mentioned earlier.
Yeah, so that's kind of once they've come to the country they're seeking asylum in. So, you know, in the UK, it's all the other things that they then have to worry about, and that they're then troubled by in terms of that process, the isolation, poverty, lack of meaningful activities. You know, many people will who are seeking asylum, you know, had jobs, had professions, families, you know, meaning in their lives prior to the conflict or prior to the events, and then they're suddenly, you know, without those things that stabilize anybody's mental health. It's very understandable for a human to feel unsettled, distressed, stressed out if they have space uncertainty and they're placed in a position where their basic choice and rights are compromised. For example, the Aspen cards, they're preloaded cards, they can only use them in certain shops. So it's not like they can have the cash and be creative and, you know, maybe go to a local market and buy food that they want to buy and at prices they would want to. They're forced to only be able to use certain shops. So it completely reduces their power as an individual to live their lives. And they can be moved almost overnight. I had a young man who was called an unaccompanied asylum seeker. So he'd come to the UK as age 16, and individuals under 18 do get, you know, a social worker and a level of local authority support. But he'd come to see me, and it was taking quite a lot of time for me to build up trust and an understanding of him and who he was. I mean, he'd come with night sweats, which I was sort of trying to investigate as his GP. And then pretty much overnight, he was moved by the local authority to another city. And so a complete break in that, being able to provide primary care for him. So yeah, huge challenges.
Something you've both mentioned is the complete disruption of lives, the isolation and boredom, and also fear of the unknown, which can cause severe anxiety for people. How long they may stay in one place for, who will they be housed with, where they're going to be moving to next. And Emily touched on it just now, but Haureen, how do you deliver continuity of care in these camps when you don't know whether patients are staying for hours or indeed years? And are you able to ensure patients take some form of medical history record with them for future reference, like if they're migrating to the UK, for example?
So at the moment in the camp, and probably most camps around the world, it's paper-based systems. So patients come to the hospital or primary healthcare centre, everything's taken, and then essentially you create that management plan, give them the treatment, etc. There's some great work done out there with organisations within the camp, such as MSF have an amazing primary healthcare non-communicable disease clinic. So non-communicable diseases being hypertension, diabetes, etc. So they have a very good follow-up system. So you have that continuity of care. They're given a week or 2 weeks worth of medication, said you need to come back at this time. If you're unable to make it to camp because you're disabled, et cetera, have difficulty coming to the health point, then they would send out their community outreach team to go and do blood pressure check, blood glucose check, et cetera. So there is continuity of care. The issue is with all these pieces of paper, inevitably something gets lost. I can't even find some of the stuff that I need for my taxes and stuff that's just lying around the house. And in a small UNHCR tent, which you may be sharing with another family, which is probably the size of a double bedroom in the UK, you have to prioritize what you keep and what you take with you when you're moving on, etc. It's really difficult in terms of the continuity and care. Within that period of patients staying in the camp, there will be some, but moving on, unfortunately, those health issues do worsen during transit.
So at the other end of the journey back in the UK, Emily, are you seeing patients who have managed to maintain a medical history record? And moving me on to the next question, how are refugees and asylum seekers accessing and approaching primary healthcare once they're in the UK? And what sort of position might they be in once they come to you?
It is really variable, kind of what position they find themselves in. You know, I have to say I've never had someone present with paperwork that they had from a camp to document their immunisation. So you often feel like you're starting from scratch a bit. So, and they may have been moved from initial accommodation. So when someone arrives in the UK, they may be placed in initial accommodation. For example, there's quite a lot in Birmingham, and then they're dispersed to what we call dispersal accommodation, which is what we have in Norwich. So they may have had a GP who's done a little bit of work in initial health assessments, started the work of maybe doing some bloodborne virus screening or catching up on their immunizations, and then they get moved. So you then sort of have to just sort of piece together. And equally with, you know, mental health support, that can be really challenging because a lot of individuals, when they've been seeking asylum in the UK, have been here for some time, that's when their symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder may start to kick in. So, as I said, they've got that time on their hands, they start to think about, you know, really quite distressing deep trauma that they've been through in their country of origin, and they may get flashbacks, nightmares, reliving that trauma. And they may then, if they are in a position to want to engage and start to heal from that trauma, they need a level of stability in their lives, which they don't have. I have referred a number of individuals who I suspect have got post-traumatic stress disorder to the mental health team. And they've said, yeah, this individual needs trauma stabilization work, but not until they're settled, not until their status is certain. That feels like a huge rejection, especially if they've unloaded their story to me, they've told it to a mental health worker as part of their assessment, they've had to tell it multiple times to the Home Office. That's re-traumatizing for them, and to then be told, no, I can't treat you because of your status, essentially. And that's really difficult for the mental health team to want to offer support, but know that they need to ensure a level of stability for them, but also for us as GP, because we're then left with someone who's deeply distressed. But of course, the most important thing is it's really hard for that individual.
Sharing traumatic experiences or mental health issues in your mother tongue can be difficult enough. But as an English-speaking GP, how are you able to communicate and build trust with your patients effectively when there is a language barrier? And how do you find the translation and languages services available to you?
It can be really tricky when you're working through an interpreter. You know, we have pretty good access to telephone interpreters, but it's using that interpreter in a skilled manner. We're not often trained on using interpreters, and it's things like talking to the patient rather than to the phone, and trying to encourage the interpreter to use the words that the individual is using, and not necessarily try to interpret it. So, for example, I had a patient the other day who was deeply distressed and kept saying, "I'm scared, I'm scared, I'm scared." And the interpreter was going, "He's saying he's scared, but I don't know what he's scared of, you know." And actually, it's okay. You don't just tell me what he's saying. And actually, that was his way of saying, "I feel on edge all the time. I'm anxious. You know, I'm worried." And in some people's native language, they don't have the words for depression or anxiety, or they express themselves in their own human way. And it's important then, because of the stigma around mental health, you know, we know in lots of cultures that there isn't access to psychiatry or mental health teams, and it's something that's really taboo. It's trying to actually normalize what they're feeling and validate what they're feeling, and say that anyone in this situation would feel distressed and anxious and worried. The mental health teams, I have to say, I'm being encouraged recently, are using interpreters more. But it's things like, you know, you may get an admin person in the mental health team who sends out an appointment letter in English to an individual, and they miss their appointment with them, and then they're told, call us, you know, within 14 days or you can't have an appointment, and they don't understand the letter, and then they've missed their chance. Using interpreters in a skilled manner and trying to understand that patient's narrative is really important.
Haureen, do you have a similar experience of working with interpreters on the camp? And how do patients access you? Is there a processing system that individuals need to go through?
So when patients are accessing our health facilities in camps, thankfully we are able to employ a lot of local doctors and lots of local nurses. So it's in the mother tongue, whether it's Arabic or Kurdish, Sorani or Kamanji Kurdish. It's really important that, as Emily's mentioned, it's about using language. It helps build trust with people. So for me, because I'm coordinating, I take a step back. I'm just essentially just trying to manage the facility. But it's what we mentioned here is raising awareness of the mental health issues and trying to normalize it. That is really important, which for anyone in the UK knows, it's really bad normalizing mental health issues, regardless of who you are. It's quite bad, and but now with the mental health gap training, etc., psychological first aid that WHO is rolling out, it's really important that this is looked at. I just wanted to go back to what Emily said about the interpreters as well, and I'm now 7 years post qualification as a GP, and earlier on in my career, if I had someone who didn't speak English and trying to get hold of the telephone interpreter, which luckily we do have access, but sometimes you'd be waiting, you'd be tempted to use the friend or relative who's brought the patient in. That's something now that I've learned is a terrible thing to do, because you're putting that person on the spot. You're expecting them to be using medical words that we know that they don't have an understanding of sometimes. And that's why we use the telephone interpreters and in-person interpreters, which I'd always recommend any GP to use, just because they've got that job because they're trained in medical language, etc., and be able to navigate our language as well as patient's language.
Haureen, you just mentioned the stigma of mental health, which is a conversation we've been having in general practice for years now. And it does bring me quite neatly onto the next question I have for you, which is, are there any myths or false information out there about refugees and asylum seeker patients that you'd like to dispel, whether that's to do with stigma, incorrect stats or data that's commonly seen, language we use, or unfair stereotypes?
Yes, I think probably that there's false information and myths from both sides. So from the patient's point of view, but also from the service point of view and the clinician's point of view. So from the patient's point of view, they may be pretty fearful of accessing services, particularly if they fall into the group, which we haven't really touched on, but it's just the undocumented migrants. So this is somebody who is quite a diverse group, but it could be somebody who, for example, has been refused their asylum. Or it could be somebody that has come to the UK on a visa, which has then expired. And these can be the most vulnerable groups because they are so terrified of deportation or being detained. So they then really don't access services until they really have to. For example, I saw a lady who we're really uncertain how she's came to the UK. She doesn't have a passport. She's been in the UK for several years, but not accessed services at all. But she has presented because she's now pregnant and quite far on in her pregnancy. And she did not want to talk about, understandably, about anything to do with her social setup. So quite fearful. And it took quite a lot of reassurance that she would be provided with maternity care and to try and reassure her that we were not going to report her and etc. There's fear and false information from the patient point of view, but also from services. So, for example, I was running a teaching session for a practice on the health needs of forced migrants, and I was asking them about who's entitled to primary care in the UK. And the practice manager said, if they're from abroad, they can only have it if it's immediately necessary. or it's urgent, you know, as a practice manager. So just trying to challenge that, because, you know, I'm sure everybody's aware, but primary care is free for all in the UK, regardless of immigration status, regardless of documentation. So that's for all, you know, asylum seekers, refugees, undocumented migrants. It is free, and yet some practices are still refusing registration. And there's a campaign called Safe Surgery Campaign, run by Doctors of the World, which is a wonderful organisation who really advocates for the health needs of forced migrants. And I'd encourage any practice to sign up to that. There's toolkits, there's training, there's lots of support that comes with becoming a safe surgery. And it's not asking practices to do anything they shouldn't already be doing. This is part of the NHS standard operating procedures. This is the basics, is to allow registration.
Thank you for signposting Safe Surgeries, Emily. We will definitely put their information and website in the description box below.
It's, you know, free to sign up, and say that does come with it. They can provide pre-training, particularly for sort of receptionists as well, you know, and the admin side of it, because it may not, it's often not the GP or the nurse that's got preconceptions or false information. It may be the sort of admin side. So it's empowering them to use interpreters, you know, when they speak to people, to provide a more inclusive and welcoming environment in practice.
That does partially answer some of my next question, which was going to be, how can practices and surgeries provide a safer space for refugees and asylum seekers? But before we do, Haureen, I wanted to know, from your perspective in your health facilities on the camps, do you observe any stigma or mistrust that goes either ways, either from the services or from the patients?
In terms of making practices more friendly to patients, like Emily said, Doctors of the World UK, absolutely fantastic with the resources they offer. One of the things that I do as well is checking what language obviously patients speak and whether they can read as well, because Doctors of the World Surgery and have great written resources in various languages for common issues, as well as written resources for how to navigate the health system as well. And that's really important. Just things that we take for granted. If we think how the NHS has changed in access over the pandemic, everything has pretty much gone digital. Things have changed. We need to help enable people to become digitally literate as well. And that's regardless of whether people seeking asylum or refugees, and also our elderly population who are UK-based anyway. It's just being mindful, or can this person get to the next appointment, etc., if they need to. I just wanted to also go back to the Aspen card that Emily mentioned as well. And it's £39-ish a week or so, but like Emily said, use can only be used in certain shops, but also taking consideration it's not contactless, and buses in most parts of the UK now are not taking cash, it's cashless. So imagine not being able to take a bus because you can't use your Aspen card, which is not contactless. And also at the start of the pandemic, not being able to order online when there was a complete lockdown. And it's these sorts of things that build mistrust and also affect people in a way that you lose your power. You can't go to the shops and buy your bread or something like that. And it's just really sad. And it's the things that I take for granted every day of my life, which we need to be mindful of. Yeah, talking about mistrust, it's really difficult. The problem is when you're living in a camp which is unable as it is to help with the current needs, the international organizations, the local organizations are doing the best that they can, but the demand is too much. Money is starting to flow out of Syria now because of other conflicts around the world, especially Ukraine, etc. A lot of European Union money for emergency funding is going. And Iraq and Syria are sort of moving towards a developmental phase of the conflict now, 11 years after the start of the Syrian war. And that's going to put a lot more pressure on these organizations, and especially the local structures as well, who are doing the best that they can with limited resources. And then, as you can imagine, if you're not getting the basics that you need, such as water, food, fuel, heat, people become disgruntled, and that is normal, and that's expected. It's not an ideal situation. A lot of people think when you get to a European country, a camp in a European country, oh, you're in Europe, it's going to be the best thing ever. It's not. I've worked in Lesbos, one of the refugee camps there, and there was a graffitied wall that says, "Welcome to Europe, where hopes and dreams die," essentially. Yeah, we think that people have come to a better place when they arrive at their final country of destination to seek asylum, but they don't, unfortunately. Unfortunately, it's a really difficult journey onwards. And as what Emily said, things worsen once you've tried to start integrating into the system. And I've got a figure here from a study, and I think it's about the after about 5 years in a host country, people show higher rates of depression and anxiety compared to the host population. It's around about 20% higher. And it's something that we need to continue to help people with, to treat them as they need to be treated.
That once again just highlights the need for mental health support that patients need any stage in their journey. And I suppose I'd like to ask you both, you're working with very vulnerable patients in very dire environments. How do you take care of yourself and your own mental well-being? And I'd also like to find out what compelled you to work in this particular specialist area of medicine, and what are your hopes for the future?
In terms of hope, one of the bugbear is language use in media reporting that these, with all due respect, these people are not from uncivilized areas. Things like that just really got to me and angered me. And that's one of my hopes for the future, is to see that everyone is treated fairly, whether it's in mass media or just in the general population, by every group, clinical workers, etc., politicians, and anyone essentially. And the other one is the diaspora that have left these countries, who are, we mentioned before, highly skilled people, mechanics, engineers, healthcare professionals, because they've left their countries and hopefully picked up where they left off with university or gaining extra skills. And I'm hoping that one day they can return to the countries, because Syria, I've been very lucky that I've been able to tour Syria, go to assess different healthcare facilities and see the destruction of just bombed out parts of hospitals, which are like running at 30% of what it was before. And hoping that the ex-locals will be able to help, because it's all well and good international people turning up, but I'm international. I will return to my life back in the UK at some point, and I'm hoping that they will be able to help in some way.
How I became interested, I had a deep-seated kind of interest in global health, and I think I had some really early positive encounters, both as a medical student but also in my first few years of being a GP, with people who'd faced forced migration. And so I guess I'm really passionate about trying to reduce the fear and feeling of helplessness that GPs and other professionals can have when meeting someone who's seeking asylum or has faced challenges. Because I think sometimes when clinicians don't necessarily behave in the appropriate way with individuals, it's because of uncertainty and feeling completely overwhelmed by this individual who's got multiple needs. So I think I'm really passionate about including in experts by experience in medical education. And I'm really honoured to have three of my patients who are asylum seekers speaking to medical students and having a really kind of equal interactive session with them. And I think that was a really positive thing for both the medical students, but also for my patients who were able to tell their story. And that's probably what keeps me going, is that I feel incredibly privileged to hear some of the stories that people have been through. You know, I don't like to see them as victims. I see them as scarred survivors who can really teach us a lot about life and humanity. And I'd like everybody to have kind of positive experiences, because I think that's what compels me to really want to advocate for this group at whatever level. And I think there are things that anyone can do. Doctors, your receptionist can, my favourite phrase is coding is caring. I think the more that we can recognise and document patients' needs, the more that we can ensure that they get the services they need. So even a doctor's receptionist can code asylum seeker on the medical record, or victim of torture, whatever it is, so that we are recognising and ensuring that we don't just provide fair services, but really just services for what these individuals need.
Yeah, so how I got into working in sort of global health was, essentially I did a master's in public health, because the people I was surrounded by, so my mum works for an international organisation. I trained with, as a GP in South Yorkshire, and my trainer, an absolute gem, Dom Patterson, who works a lot with health inequalities. So I have a lot to owe to him, because he as Emily mentioned about coding is caring, he went through essentially all of our patient lists and developed this code to identify people with the biggest health inequalities, regardless of where they're from. And that took months and years essentially doing that. But it inspired me to say, I've got these skills, I'm privileged. And I ended up doing a master's in public health and then just ended up working in global health, which is quite good. I enjoy it. It's difficult for sure. How I keep my mental health and well-being in check is I'm using exercise as a great tool, speaking to the people around me and trusting in the organization as well, who have a psychologist on hand if I need to. And it's mandatory pre-departure, middle of deployment, post-departure, and whenever we need to in the middle. Yeah, it's just talking, journaling, and just being mindful that you are in a difficult position and accepting that. And there's no shame in saying that you may be struggling with stress, mental health. And that's one thing that I'd also say to anyone, any of our healthcare professional staff, colleagues, is just recognizing it and doing what you can to improve your mental health.
I think particularly when someone tells you some of the deepest things that they've been through, you know, although it's a privilege, it can be really tough. And I think, as Hareen says, it's acknowledging that, you know, and there's been times when someone's told me about torture or something really deep and traumatic. And it's okay to sort of have a breather and say, wow, it's incredible they've shared it with me, but that's, I need to reflect on that and I need to take a breather and acknowledge that and be mindful if that is having some impact on me or the next patient that I'm about to see. If my mind is still with that person, I can't really do justice to the next patient. When there are things that can help with that, having double appointments, you know, having I try not to have a complete clinic which is back to back initial health assessments, because I need to have a bit of normality and a normal general practice. Otherwise, I think you're at risk of burning out and that vicarious trauma, which we understand a lot more about, especially in light of the COVID pandemic, because although that's shone a light on health inequalities, it's also the worst, and we're seeing a lot more consequences because of that. I think the other thing that really helps me is working with some amazing community organisations, which are just really inspiring, and being able to share risk with them, really sharing complexity with them. I've got some really good links with the Red Cross in Norwich, but also some other third sector organisations who support this group, and being able to, you know, with the patient's consent, obviously just share and say, perhaps to their support worker, or if there's someone they trust within the community organisation, I've seen so-and-so, they're really struggling, could you give them a call and invite them to, because they have community lunches, etc. And being able to share that with them, I think is really helpful, definitely.
That brings us to the end of this podcast. A huge thanks to our guests for sharing their thoughts and experiences. And thank you for listening to Team GP Perspectives. Look out for the other episodes in this special mini-series, where displaced doctors share their journeys, and we'll also talk to GPs involved with projects supporting displaced doctors. Check out the description below to find links to the projects and schemes discussed today, as well as other related resources. And if you're enjoying these conversations, then please share them with a friend or tweet us at @teamgp. That's all for now. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.